Today at Reader's Corner, we talk to Franklin Foer, author of World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Over the past few decades, there has been a revolution in terms of who controls knowledge and information. This rapid change has imperiled the way we think. We shop with Amazon, we socialize on Facebook, we turn to Apple for entertainment, and we rely on Google for information. But is there a hidden price we're paying beyond that cheap shipping and low monthly subscription? In his new book, World Without Mind, Franklin Foer argues that today's monopolists are seeking access to every facet of our identities and influence over every corner of our decision-making. While few have grasped the sheer scale of the threat, Foer explains not just the looming existential crisis, but the imperative of resistance. Franklin Foer is a national correspondent for The Atlantic, a New America Foundation fellow, former editor of The New Republic. His writing has appeared in Slate, New York Magazine, and many other outlets. He is the author of How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization. Franklin Foer, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much.
Well, I was so excited about this book, and I've have to admit that I've got kind of stoked about it, and I'm starting to do things differently than I used to do, which we can talk about later on in the interview. But I want to start with asking you kind of a basic question. There are so many good reasons in your book why we need to stop, hit the pause button, and decide how much technology we really need in our lives. Was there a moment or a series of moments for you that prompted the writing of this book?
You know, I actually kind of winded my way into my thesis. It's not like I kind of came at this topic from a position of Luddism or even tech skepticism. For a lot of my life, I've been fairly enthusiastic about new technology. So when the Kindle first came out, I was one of the first people to buy it. I had an iPhone at a relatively early stage. And so I was inviting these companies into my life, and there were two real moments where I started to think differently about the big technology companies. The first was with Amazon, which is that I'm a writer, and I could see the way in which Amazon had become so important in the book business. And I had published one book with a French publishing conglomerate called Hachette, and they were involved in a negotiation with Amazon over their ebook contract. And Hachette pushed back against Amazon and said, you know, we can only give you so much in terms of the profit margin and all these things you're asking of us. We can only give so much. We're not going to give you any more. And Amazon punished them by stripping the buy button off of their books on the Amazon website, by charging extra for shipping or by redirecting searches for one book to a book on a similar topic by another publisher. And so that started to get me thinking about the role that Amazon plays in our economy and what it means for us to be so dependent on Amazon. And that was back in about 2014. And, you know, the second thing that happened was, as a journalist, I was editor of the New Republic magazine, and our publication got bought by Chris Hughes, who was Mark Zuckerberg's roommate in college and who was Facebook employee number three. And he started off owning the New Republic with very, very high-minded intentions. He had a great program. But as we went on, he started to get panicked about the magazine. And so we started to go through this really compressed period of recent journalistic history in a microcosm, where we started to become extremely dependent on Facebook and started to produce content for Facebook. And I could see what would happen when Facebook, as Facebook has become so dominant in the distribution of news, it's shaping the way that news gets produced. And so you end up in a situation like the 2016 election, where so much misinformation was flowing through Facebook and the quality of information flowing through Facebook was so poor. That seemed to me like something that was a long time coming, and I could see happening much more broadly across the profession. So to answer your question, you know, I arrived at my conclusion really through personal experience and through a very specific experience, and it wasn't an inevitable progression for me. It was something where I was just rattled by the way in which I was intersecting with these tech companies in my own career.
Well, let's expand on your comments regarding Amazon. And you do talk in the book about the experiences that publishers have had trying to negotiate with Amazon. And I wonder if you could help our listeners understand what impact that has on creativity in general, what impact Yeah. that has on author income, and eventually Mm-hmm. what impact that has on the availability of good literature in our society when, in fact, you have a company that is just kind of dumbing it down. And you might mention in addition, when Bezos originally set the ebook price and how that fits into this argument as well.
Right. So at first, when Amazon came on the scene, it was looked on as a savior because I don't know if your readers happen to remember Barnes & Noble and Borders, which were the biggest players in the book business for quite a while. Book publishers looked on Amazon as initially as this other outlet, this challenger to these other big guys. And so they welcomed it into their lives. And Amazon developed the Kindle, which was the first mass market e-reader. And they were very, very excited about that too. But the moment the Kindle was unveiled, they were shocked because when Jeff Bezos unveiled the product, he said, the cost of every ebook is going to be $9.99 and the price is going to keep going down as this device matures. And publishers, you know, they were startled by this because there'd been no discussion with Amazon about the pricing of the ebook. And publishing is an expensive business. And part of the reason it's an expensive business is because writers, you know, to write a book, you have to focus, you have to kind of pour over your sentences. If you're a nonfiction writer, it involves a great deal of research. This is not something most people can do after work or waking up at 5 a.m. It takes concentration. It takes time. And if you want to have professional writers, you have to pay them for their time. You have to pay them for all of the work that goes into producing a book. And in the book business, the book publishers operate almost like venture capitalists. And so if I go to my book publisher with an idea and they approve of the idea, they'll pay me in advance to subsidize my life as I go through the process of producing the book. They're making a guess about how many copies of the book will ultimately be sold and what type of financial risk they're taking on a project. And that's what supports the whole economy of professional writing. And so as Amazon has become more and more dominant, what they've done is they tried to replace the book publishers and they wanted writers self-publishing through Amazon. And simultaneously, they've tried to squeeze more profit out of the book publishers by paying them less for each copy sold. And what book publishers do is they pass along, it's not like they're passing along that cost to them. As they get squeezed by Amazon, they in turn squeeze the writers. And so they pay writers less and less or pay them over long periods of time. They make it harder and harder to sustain a living through professional writing. And, you know, my argument is that over the long run, this comes at a cost. It makes writing potentially more of an elite profession. If you're not getting paid as much to produce a book, you need to have resources that come from elsewhere. It diminishes the opportunity, and also it diminishes the quality because at least with nonfiction, reporting is expensive and research is time consuming. And if you're not getting paid as much to write a book, you're going to spend, you know, you don't have the resources to do those things and you'll probably spend less time doing them and the quality will go down.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Franklin Foer, author of World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. Well, I want to make sure I get all these culprits in, so let's switch over to Google for a moment.
Yeah.
Regarding Google's Master Project, tell us about that and where that leads us, where it leads humanity, you might say.
So one of the things that's so interesting is if you, and I recommend to your readers is to spend time on Facebook, looking for the times where the founders of these big tech companies talk about their view of the world, because they say incredibly interesting things about human nature and about the future of civilization. And Larry Page, who is one of the co-founders of Google, is an enthusiast for ideas about immortality and an enthusiast for ideas about how about our merger with technology. And there's one particular version of this called the singularity, which is that as we start to merge with machines, and Sergey Brin, who's the other co-founder of Google, talks about the day when Google will will be implanted in our brain. And as we merge with machines, human consciousness and existence starts to change. There'll be the day where we could potentially upload our consciousness into the cloud, and our being becomes separate from our bodies. And there's a whole rapturous literature about how wonderful it will be when we hit this day, this moment where we fully merge with the machine. And I think it's implicit in Google that their mission is to hasten the day when we merge with the machine, when we're able to become truly immortal, and when life on this planet starts to change forever. And that informs a lot of the investments that they're making in life sciences and in artificial intelligence. And there's this utopianism that I think drives the company and where it's headed.
And whether it's Google or whether it's Facebook, one of your concerns in this book is the accumulation of the data, our data, data that we own as individual consumers, but becomes the data of Google. I wonder if you could help us understand what your data protection authority would do in this situation.
Yeah, so data is a very bloodless world. We talk about data, it sounds so abstract, but data is essentially this map of our psyche. It's everything, every place we've clicked on the internet, everything we've read, it's our swipes on our phones, it's our likes on Facebook. The price of computing is so cheap that every single scrap of data is saved. And what it does is it provides these companies with this enormous database where they look for correlations, and they're able to identify the things that give us pleasure and the things that cause us anxiety. And they are in turn able to use that sense of what we like and what we disdain to try to influence our behavior. And so with Facebook, they use it to try to get us to stay on their site for as long as possible. Amazon, they use it to try to get us to buy things as much as possible. And it's my argument that that data is so intimate that it demands government protection. And also, the process of manipulation is so intrusive and so threatening that there needs to be protections against that as well. And one of the things that I think is just gobsmacking is that we have no protection. We're completely naked in the face of this invasion of privacy. There's no national data protection law. California has something that they passed last year. What I'm proposing is that we have a national data protection law, that we have a governmental agency, much like maybe the Federal Communications Commission, that is committed to regulating the collection of data and devoted to protecting us against manipulation.
So for those of us who might be interested, especially after reading your book, in disconnecting or in drawing a line somewhere, asserting our independence from big tech, I happen to think that a few years ago, I went on to DuckDuckGo, which is the alternative search engine. In fact, I think it calls itself the search engine that doesn't track you. I guess the question is that search engine any good compared to how effective Google is at taking us places we want to go?
Right. I
What's
mean,
your thoughts?
it's not bad. I think the problem is that for a lot of us, you know, the word Google is a verb, and it's identified. Googling is the process of searching is identified almost inherently with this one site, and we get locked into these systems where it becomes very, very hard to move. I mean, my mail is Gmail. My office's mail is Gmail. Yeah. It becomes impossible to imagine leaving the system once you're tethered to it in the way that we are. That's why I think that ultimately we need governmental protection. It's almost impossible for us as citizens to protect us properly, which isn't to say that we should be passive as citizens. What these companies want to steal from us is our attention. And even if we have government helping us on that front, I mean, really, it's up to ourselves to preserve and protect our attention and prevent it from getting commandeered by these companies. I'm a big fan of the poet Mary Oliver, and she has a phrase that I just think about all the time, where she wrote, "Attention is the beginning of devotion." That in order to be able to love something, we need to be able to see it. She wrote a lot about nature, and in order to really appreciate nature, we need to be able to see the difference between one tree and the next, and the shape of one leaf from another. And you can only do that by dilating, opening your eyes, and looking hard. And if you're staring down at your device, or if your attention is constantly being redirected by a notification on your phone, you know, we have these things that are always buzzing and dinging and summoning us. And they cause us, they release dopamine in us. The rush of the phone is something that we struggle to resist because they've been engineered in such a way to make it very difficult for us to resist. But if attention is the beginning of devotion, it means that it is this core quality, this core skill that we need in order to be loving human beings who appreciate the world that we've inherited, to be thinking human beings, to be capable of independent political thoughts. And so we can't be passive in the face of this kind of massive, violent effort to steal our attention away from us. We need to cultivate active strategies for resistance.
You're listening to Franklin Foer. He's the author of World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. Let's talk about the impact of big tech on journalism. You have a quote early in your book where you say, "To survive, media companies lost track of their values. Even journalists of the highest integrity have internalized a new mindset. They worry about how they can successfully pander to Google's and Facebook's algorithms." And then later on in your book, you refer to Chartbeat and CrowdTangle. And maybe you could take us inside the newsroom, inside the daily life of a reporter, as to what's going on that's different today in terms of how they're subservient to, if that's the word, these algorithms from Google or Facebook or wherever.
Right. So if you were to step into the Washington Post or the New York Times newsrooms, you'd see giant screens hovering above them that show the popularity of each article on the site at any given moment. And some of these will show how an article is performing on social media. And when I was an editor, I had access to a piece of analytics software called Chartbeat. And it was like this odometer that would show how many people were on the site at any given moment, how long they were reading articles for. And you could see what would make the difference between a successful and unsuccessful article on Chartbeat was essentially how they were performing on Facebook. And once you have this knowledge about what's popular and what's not popular, it starts to really weigh on your thinking. And because we're human beings, we want to be popular. We want to generate things that are read by as many people as possible. And once you start to see the patterns, you know exactly what sort of article is successful on Facebook and what's not. And you then start to pander to the algorithms. You start to produce articles that past data shows are much more likely to be successful. And I think this helps account for a lot of the sameness that we see in journalism and a lot of the convergence where there might be something that looks ephemeral or kind of stupid, and it ends up resulting in hundreds and hundreds of articles. Whether it was in my book, I cite the example of a lion called Cecil, who was like the Kim Kardashian of lions, who was a very, very beloved, popular celebrity lion who was killed by a Minnesota dentist and who posted a picture on Facebook standing next to the corpse of the lion. And this generated a huge amount of outrage. And people, journalists, could see how it was trending, and they all tried to scrape popularity from this subject. And there were literally millions upon millions of articles written about the death of Cecil the Lion, which obviously a subject worthy of outrage, but was it worthy of consuming as much journalistic resources and attention as it did? And I would say no. I think that that's an example of the way in which the profession's dependence on big tech has distorted the values of the profession.
Well, regarding that, what does Zuckerberg mean when he says that Facebook wants to talk about radical transparency?
And what Facebook has always tried to do is to get you to share as much of your life as possible, to get you as comfortable with surrendering data and privacy. And so over the course of the company's history, you know, they'll from time to time talk about their concern for privacy, but really, if you go back and you look at his statements over time, he doesn't really care that. I mean, his goal is the opposite of preservation of privacy. His goal is to destroy privacy, to get us to this point where we're comfortable living our lives on a digital stage for all the world to see. And so, you know, sure, there might be embarrassing facts that about us or embarrassing photos with us that get posted from time to time. But, you know, once we realize that everybody is human, everybody's done embarrassing things in our lives, we'll come to think of this as second nature. We'll lose all inhibition about sharing things. And then suddenly Facebook will have not just access to our photos, but they'll have complete and total access to all the data that we could possibly generate, which they in turn can use to manipulate us and to sell ads to us. Mm-hmm.
Zuckerberg probably takes more grief than the other tech leaders when it comes to breakup talk. Just the other day, I heard CBS News ask him point blank, do you think Facebook is too big? Do you think it should break up? By the way, he did answer that it was too big. I'm not so sure he gave a very definitive answer on whether the breakup should occur tomorrow. But I wonder what your thoughts are. In your book, you talk about Justice Brandeis and the work that he did legally and constitutionally in justifying the breakup of monopolies back in the day, so to speak. I wonder if you could just talk to us about Zuckerberg and where you think Facebook is going.
Right. So the idea of breaking up a company like Facebook seems pretty radical to us now. But if we just travel back in time, maybe 40 years, it was something that happened with much greater regularity, especially when it came to a company like Facebook that's involved in so many areas that we should consider central to democracy and the preservation of individual autonomy. And because of Facebook's role in the 2016 election, it's come under heightened scrutiny. And because Zuckerberg has flailed a little bit in response to criticism, critics have really zeroed in on Facebook as the first of these big tech companies that they're going to try to break up. And, you know, what does it mean to break up Facebook? Well, over time, what Facebook has done is it's purchased potential rivals. So in the form of Instagram or WhatsApp. And I think the idea is that it would be possible to unwind some of these mergers. And Zuckerberg, I think, feels under such pressure, he'll make concessions like the one that you just described, and he'll say that maybe Facebook should be regulated. I think that his instinct is that he'd rather have government regulate Facebook than have government break up Facebook, that they're willing to accept all sorts of rules. And they may even find ways to leverage those rules to inhibit other people from getting into their businesses, because rules are expensive for companies and make it harder sometimes for companies to start up. But I don't think he's going to ever support the idea of breaking himself up. Maybe some of the other big tech companies, it's easier to imagine why CEOs would be happy to split their companies into multiple parts. But with Zuckerberg, he needs to have he needs to have Instagram, he needs to have WhatsApp, because those help provide him with his data advantage. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that make his company so hard for any other social media firm to compete with.
Now I want to get to the question that I find one of the most interesting in your book, and that's the question that a lot of readers are going to have when they close your book is, what should I be doing? What can I do differently? Is there a way to disconnect? Is there a way to step back from this pervasive influence of big tech? And you made a decision. And by the way you described your tech history, mine's identical. I have to, I hate to admit that I have 7 Kindles. They're not all operating, obviously, but I kept graduating from one to the other over the years. You gave up your Kindle. I wonder if you could talk about that and talk even more specifically about the alternative, which is going back to the book, paper book.
So when we think about tech, there's this sense of inevitability that it's so hard to resist it. And when the Kindle came around, people said that it would be impossible to resist as well. That Nicholas Negroponte, who was the head of the MIT Media Lab, said when the Kindle was unveiled that there would be no paper books published by the year 2015. And lo and behold, here we are, and paper books continue to be published. And I think that collectively, judging by book sales, there's been this subconscious decision that a lot of people have made to stick with paper, that we live our lives on screens and we're constantly being distracted. And reading is the ultimate private activity. We do it in the bathtub, we do it in our bed, and it's just this way for us to sit with a paper book, which has no capacity for showing you your email, or your book doesn't vibrate with a notification that takes you away from whatever you're thinking. It's a refuge from the digital world, where we're able to really tend to our minds, tend to our humanness, to preserve our capacity for attention. And the fact that ebook sales have plateaued, the fact that independent bookstores seem to be making a very unlikely comeback, all these things should be inspiration for us in other parts of our lives, that just because we ventured into this digital world and there are lots of great and wonderful things about it, doesn't mean that we need to accept every single facet of it. And it doesn't mean that we need to accept our dependence on these big corporations, and we can actually array our lives in a way that protect the things that we deem worthy of defense.
Well, Franklin, that's a good way to leave this interview. We're going to tell our listeners to get out there and buy a copy of the book, the paper book, that is, World Without Mind, The Existential Threat of Big Tech. And from there, visit your independent bookstore regularly here in Boise. That's Rediscovered Books. Franklin Ford, thanks so much for joining us today.
Pleasure.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.